You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Mika Hollander, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're the CEO and co-founder of Sustain Natural. How do you describe Sustain these days?
Sustain Natural is a brand of vagina-friendly essentials. So we make everything from condoms to tampons to organic lubricant. Basically, if it goes in, on, or around your vagina, we make it.
Wow. Give people a little bit of the breadth of products that you're offering these days.
So we have what we call, we sort of like have a division in our portfolio of sex and period products. So we got our start in the condom industry. So we make everything from condoms to organic lubricant to post-play wipes. And we recently, within the last year and a half, expanded into the period product space with organic cotton tampons, pads, and liners. And recently launched organic cotton period-proof underwear, as well as a reusable period cup.
I want to go into all of those things, but I think for context, your co-founder is your father. I think that's a really important thing. He's the founder of Seventh Generation. I think people would be familiar with that brand. How did you end up becoming co-founders with your dad?
Well, I think most people dream of starting a condom company with their dad. So I think, you know, most people can relate.
I've always thought that too.
It's like, I mean, yeah, I think it's funny how many people mention that to me. I grew up sort of almost traumatized by entrepreneurship to a certain extent. I've always been very close to my dad. Seventh Generation was effectively my older sibling. We were basically like born the same year and sort of grew up together. And I grew up very closely sort of behind the scenes of like everything that goes on when you're starting a company and trying to get it off the ground. And then once you sort of hit the inflection point of success, oh wait, it doesn't get any easier. So I always was like, I'm never starting a company. Like that looks really terrible. And then on the flip side, sort of grew up thinking about natural products and knowing the space and getting to learn the space and seeing my dad is obviously a real pioneer in the natural products industry. And he ended up leaving Seventh Generation when I was in business school. And so we were sort of at totally different points in our lives at the same moment of like, what are we going to do? And I thought I knew what I wanted to do, was still sort of figuring that out. He contemplated, oh, maybe I shouldn't start another company. Maybe I should just teach or be a consultant, or he didn't really know either, but he went back to, as I think most entrepreneurs do, like what I know how to do and what I'm good at is starting and building businesses. And that's what I want to do again. And I was like, all right, well, let's talk about that. And we ended up revisiting an idea he'd had 15 or 20 years prior of creating the world's most sustainable condom company. And that evolved into Sustain over time and sort of took on a different meaning and a new form than he had originally thought. But it was interesting. And family business is interesting. And there's a lot there too. But it was sort of like we were both trying to figure out our plan at the same moment in time and stumbled into a family condom startup.
But it wasn't, I think what's interesting and unique is that it is really like a co-founder relationship because it wasn't passed down to you. It was something you started together, which is very unusual, I think.
Super unusual. I was in business school at NYU. I was talking to the family business professor. There's like a class on that there. I was asking peers who had gone into family businesses, you know, what's it like? Pretty much everybody said, don't do it. it's really challenging. It creates a strain on your relationship with your parent or family. The dynamics are weird. The employees don't treat you the same way as if you went into another business. But I actually could not find anyone who had, as you said, started something at the same time as sort of peers and partners and co-founders.
Did you have a close relationship with your dad growing up?
Very close. Very close relationship, which actually in some ways made it more challenging We had really only known each other as father-daughter friends, maybe. We were very close, very open. But the relationship obviously shifted when we started a business together because you're business partners. You know, I'm not just going to say, oh, it's okay, you're my dad, I'm going to cut you some slack, and vice versa. It's the same way that you would want to hold your co-founder accountable on certain things. So I couldn't find anybody to sort of give me an insight into what this looks like in founding a business with a parent. And so that led me into taking a leap of faith and doing it and figuring it out myself.
How did you two decide how the leadership of the company was going to work? Because you were right out of school and you became the CEO immediately, right? Or how did that work? Was he training you on that job, or how did
Yeah, basically. I didn't become the only CEO until December of 2017. So
gotcha.
We went through a period where initially he was the CEO. I was just like the co-founder, marketing and sales. Like, we didn't really like define it. Then for most of our time together, we were co-CEOs. Mm. And that, yeah, it's challenging. I mean, he did, and he still is my number one coach and mentor. But it was challenging because, like, I entered initially into this, okay, I'm leading a business and starting a business with my dad, who's like so respected, has all this experience, but also has never built a brand online, has, you know, no digital experience. Not that I really did either, but we had different strengths and weaknesses. And the real learning from him came from not like, okay, how do I like make the P&L? It came from like, how do you build a team? How do you hire people? How do you deal with these different types of situations? He taught me small and large things, but the coaching was really about how do you lead and grow a business and build a business and raise money and stuff like that. It was weird. I mean, I think even when we were co-CEOs for him, how does he see me as his equal partner? You can talk to him about that. I think that was challenging. In ways, it's easier now that I'm leading the business on my own, and he's really just the chair of the board and a mentor to me.
I feel like it makes it extra hard that you picked an area that most people never want to think about their parents having sex at all. Like, how did that conversation come about? And it seems like you personally have a strong voice and opinion in that area. And he had an idea for a product or a business that came from beforehand. How did those two things mesh together?
Well, I think a lot of it, you know, I can probably count on my hand, like, the number of times where we've had like really awkward moments from like TMI dad, like not as much information of your use of the products, but we, you know, it's a business. And so I think it was funny to us at first and sort of quirky that we were starting sort of a sexual wellness products business together. But it wasn't actually until we launched and until we were out in the world talking to retailers, investors, speaking together, like, other people made it more quote unquote uncomfortable than we had, because we're not sitting around talking. I mean, I'm not sitting around today with all my team talking about sex all the time. Like, of course we talk about sex and we talk about sexual health and we talk about, should we do a blog post on anal sex? Of course. But sorry, I hope people didn't just like turn off the podcast.
That's fine.
but it's not like, it's a business, you know, it's a health products company. It's a medical device. And so my dad and I didn't have a lot of awkward moments. Of course there were some. I mean, I remember very clearly, like, sitting in New York City outside at a restaurant, my dad, my mom, and I, and we were like talking about how initially a lot of customers were like, your condoms are too small. Were they really too small? Should we make an extra large, et cetera? And the people next to us like got up and moved tables. They were like, what the hell is going on here? But that wasn't because I felt uncomfortable, right? That was like somebody else made me feel uncomfortable. So it really, like, we grew up with a pretty open household. Like, I told my dad the first time I was thinking about having sex. I talked about birth control with him. I talked about it with my mom. It wasn't a one-time conversation where condoms were just like thrown in my face or like slipped under my door in the middle of the night while I was sleeping. Like, it didn't feel as taboo and sort of stigmatized as I would realize other people would see it as.
What was it in particular that your parents did? Or if you were going to tell other parents like how to raise your child, what are some of the things that they did well around this topic?
Well, so that's the interesting thing, because I've been asked that question a lot, and I don't have kids yet myself, but it's not just about sex. It's not just about this topic. It's about how do you create an environment and a relationship with your kids where they feel comfortable coming to you when they're thinking about doing something, when they're in a crisis, when they're dealing with something emotionally and they need help or they're confused. Like, how do you create that dynamic and fluid conversation from the beginning so that when they're thinking about having sex or you want to talk to them about having sex, it's not this like, oh my God, everybody sit around the dining room table, like let's pull out the condom and banana and like do this once and never talk about it again. And so what my parents were really great at was, you know, they were my parents, but I felt comfortable talking to them about relationships and about friendships and about drinking and drugs. Like I wasn't scared to go say like, hey mom, like I'm hungover and I'm upset and something happened last night. Like I need your help. I need your advice. That made it really much easier. And I think a lot more effective to then go into sort of open dialogues about sex and safe sex, beyond that.
I don't have kids either, so we're both just
talking. So everyone's like, guys, shut up.
But, you know, one thing I was thinking about recently, I a few years ago, I started going to, like, saunas more. And it was really my first time, like, being exposed to a lot more men who were completely nude. The only other experience that I had like that was really when I was in college. I was like a drawing and art minor. So we did, you know, figure drawings and that kind of thing. But I started, you know, walking around these like sauna type places where you're basically just everything is out. And I wish that I had seen that as a young boy, because it would have made me realize like everyone has something, everyone's got different stuff going on. And that's just like humans. That's how we are. But I think a lot of people in like Western cultures are, I don't know, very ashamed of their bodies. And it's just kind of a thing that I'm glad you're addressing it with what you're doing with your company. It's just a topic that is just a constant reminder. And I think it starts with childhood. It starts with having a really good relationship with your parents that is open that way.
And it's really so important that it comes from parents, because when you look at, you know, I think over the last like 10 or 15 years, there were $2 billion that went towards abstinence-only education in the U.S. The U.S., by many standards, is one of the most, if not the most, sexually repressed society and culture globally. When you're dealing with like really big political and sort of like social issues where change is going to take a long time, and obviously we're working on a lot of that with Sustain, it does fall on the parents, and it falls on like, how are you going to enable these conversations with your kids? Because who knows what they're going to get in school? You really can't count on that. And I think especially with the internet and like the pervasiveness of porn and like it's everywhere and people are going online and kids are going online, like the more open dialogue you have at home, the better. But again, as you said, I don't have a kid, so I think I know what I'm talking about. But
you were on the receiving end of an education that seemed to work, and that's rare. I don't think that is the common. I think that's the like 5% of the case situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been some great research done in the New York Times over the last few years around this sort of sex conversation. The majority of parents have it once.
Hmm.
No, that's not enough. It's not a one. Sex isn't a one-time conversation. Like you can't learn about bodies and differences that you're talking about, like you got in the sauna, and pleasure and condoms and STDs and getting to, I mean, it's an ongoing conversation and it evolves over time and it changes in different relationships. And so I think we have a lot of gap closing to do around the sort of sex conversation.
When you are out there talking about sustain and the and these different topics, I know you've also written a book called Get on Top. What's the pushback like? Are people more willing than they were before to hear this?
Yeah, there's been a really dramatic shift in sort of like the general receptiveness towards sexual wellness and sex as a conversation as it relates to business and fundraising and being taken seriously since the 2016 election. It's sort of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's dramatic. And I think what was challenging prior, but has been cool to watch since, is that massive shift in the conversation and the interest. It's dramatically impacted our business in terms of growth. But I'm kind of grateful that I was also around trying to do this before, because it was really challenging, but it gave me a very, you know, it's great that a huge segment of the population has shifted and decided to say, you know what, this matters. I'm speaking up. I'm standing up. I'm taking a stand for my pleasure, my reproductive rights, etc. But there's still a lot of people who aren't there. And I have a really good sense of like what that dynamic's like. So the way that I sort of describe it is, before the election, first of all, I'm a young woman with an unknown business selling condoms with her dad. They're fair trade. Nobody knows that, you know, there's a lot of these like quirky things going on. And I'm out there being like, all right, just women, do you have sex? Do you buy condoms? Do you buy them regularly? What brand are you buying? Okay, here's why you should consider ours. Like getting through all these different layers to get to actually the point at which someone would be convinced to buy Sustain was really challenging. And this top of the funnel of like, are you having sex? Are you comfortable talking to about it? Are you uncomfortable buying these products? Are you comfortable engaging with a brand regularly about these products? Like, a lot of that top piece basically like disappeared overnight with the election. And people were like, screw this. This matters. I have sex. It's fine. I don't care if you know, X, Y, and Z is uncomfortable with that fact. And I'm going to stand up for myself and I'm going to take my sexual health and sexual wellness seriously. So it's been pretty dramatic. Of course, there's still like people who laugh when you tell them what you do, but it's dramatically different than before the election.
And is that also in terms of the exposure men have had? I think obviously like the Me Too movement has been sort of happening, you know, since then as well. Is that part of it as well?
The Me Too movement is hugely, I mean, I'm basically saying all of this sort of social women focused movements that have come out of backlash to the current president, the Women's March, the Me Too movement, Time's Up, all of this stuff, and everything that's happening with Planned Parenthood and reproductive rights and what's at stake, and the recent, you know, Supreme Court nomination, all of this has enforced this sort of awakening among women that has led to, at least for us, a much easier conversation with customers and a huge reception and sort of demand for the brand. And so it's all of that, which is interesting, right? Because all this stuff was going on before Trump. More of it's at stake because of him. And it's obviously a lot of stuff's gotten worse. But the Me Too movement was spurred by stuff that's been happening for decades. There was just an inflection point with the election. So it's interesting because like even years ago, I remember, were like, how do we as a brand engage in or not around the sexual harassment and sexual assault conversation? That's challenging. Why are we the authority? Like, maybe we're not. Who do we need to partner with? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, there's a lot of people working on this conversation and this movement and change is actually happening. So we get to participate where it makes sense. But it's not, you know, before I almost felt like there's so much for us to address because I wanted to address all of these issues. And now it allows us to be a little bit more focused and actually focus on where we can have the biggest impact.
You know, before the Me Too movement, I was exposed to a few people. I have a very good friend who was assaulted, you know, as a young woman, and we had talked a lot about it, and I knew that that existed. But I think since then, I've come to realize, like, what I learned, at least in the past couple of years, is that that's the norm. It's not actually a thing that happens sometimes. It happens all the time to most women. And that kind of like ratio, the percentage of how much of that happens, radically shifted. And I think that at least that visibility to men has been really, really huge. So I assume that must have helped in conversations, or at least like making your business and your products like more legitimate to men. I don't know if you hear, like, I don't know if what you hear from men when you talk about this kind of stuff, or what you hear from men who've just been living in America for the past 2 years.
It's interesting because it's not a lot of the stigma, even just around periods, which I think has really dissipated a lot in the last years because of, for a lot of different reasons, and a lot of even brands that came before us. It comes from men, and it comes from their, you know, discomfort with these topics. Like, I was sitting with a group of women a couple months ago, like in Palm Springs by the pool. Like, people were drinking, everybody was relaxed. We're talking about the new period cup and it's reusable. And a guy came over and everybody sort of was like, oh no, you, like, you walked into the wrong conversation. And the guy kind of agreed with that. You know, he's like, oh yeah, no, I don't want to hear about this. Like, this dynamic is changing, but it's still there. And a lot of the stigma does come from men not wanting to engage. Periods are different than sex, obviously. I think with the Me Too stuff, I completely agree with you. And I think the experience that you had where you realized this is not the exception, it's the rule, is what a lot of men have been going through. And I think that has created a challenge for, I know, men, and what have they done, and reevaluating their behavior, and did they ever cross the line or not? And where is the line? Like, that's a whole other sort of conversation. The intensity of which women have stood up and raised their hand and used their voice has come from this not exception, it's the rule. Because when the president, before he became president, was openly talking about sexual harassment and joking about it, that made women uncomfortable. It brought them back. It made you rethink everything that you've been through. It made me, I mean, I've had experiences where I've pushed them under the rug. I don't want to think about them. And I wouldn't even, you know, necessarily have like raised my hand and said I've had those experiences before, but all of a sudden it's important, because if we don't speak up, they continue to happen.
Has anything changed for you about the way you talk about these things since the election? Or was it basically your narrative, your ideas haven't changed, it's just the world has opened up to it?
I mean, I think it's my experiences, my ideas, like the core of what I'm doing and why I'm passionate about it hasn't changed. It's constantly being validated as something that's really important and a reason to get up and go in the morning and work as hard as I do. But also, yeah, I mean, it's also how some things do change. I mean, all of these movements that we're talking about, of course, make you want to reevaluate, how are we talking about this issue? How do we not just become another hashtag feminism brand? How do we actually do work that's important and make a difference? And I think that is going to be a trend over the next few years, which is, we've been here, you know, Sustain's been here for a while. We've been here for almost 5 years, but there's a lot of brands that have popped up in light of everything that's going on. And that's great. I mean, we should all be having more conversations, having more options in the sexual wellness space, in the women's health space. But I think it's really going to come down to authenticity and what are you doing to make a difference? Because it's not just enough to say, this is, you know, trending right now, so I should, you know, position my brand against it. And for us, we do a lot of like internal thinking and dialogue around how do we make sure that when the Supreme Court nomination happens, we're not just posting Believe Women, we're actually making a significant donation to RAIN and to sexual assault survivors, because just saying we agree is part of it, but it's not all of it.
One of the big shifts, at least from what was happening with Seventh Generation for your dad to now, is the movement towards direct-to-consumer. And so you now have a much more direct relationship with your customers. Was that something where you maybe felt like you could actually educate your dad on some of those things?
Yeah, definitely. I think he actually used to say this thing that really bothered me, but it's sort of funny now. Like, right when we got started and we would be talking to investors, he'd be like, and she's really good at social media. And I was like, that's offensive. Like, I know how to do more than that. But to him, that was, it was so important and critical in like building a successful brand in like a digitally native time. So he, you know, he didn't grow up on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, buying stuff online, Amazon. That was it, it and still is like very unfamiliar to him. So I'm constantly educating him, but he also, you know, in taking a step back and getting out of the day to day over the last year was sort of like, you know what? Like I've had my fair share of learnings. Like I've built a lot of businesses. Like I'm good on like understanding how Facebook advertising works. so it's been, you know, he's interested and I've taught him a lot. And then at a certain point over the last year and a half, as our D2C business really exploded, it's been about hiring experts in that space, because I'm not even obviously an expert at something like acquisition marketing.
A topic that we talk a lot about on the podcast is just the influencer marketing approach and all the different, you know, new ways that are evolving on how to market a brand. It seems like getting people to talk about this is challenging. How do you get people to share with their friends that they're buying from you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll say it's gotten easier as we've expanded the portfolio. To some people, maybe it seems like posting about a condom and posting about a tampon is similar, but I would say a lot more people are posting or comfortable posting off the bat about, you know, period products than they are about sexual wellness, because this inherent idea that women have and enjoy sex is still something that is unfamiliar and sort of uncomfortable for a lot of people. But it's, you know, I think you, for us, it hasn't, that's actually, influencer marketing has actually been one of the easier things, because I feel like we've done such a great job at creating a brand that stands for something, and that the feedback we get all the time is like, you're fighting on my behalf. So whether it's on, you know, reproductive rights, whether it's about tampon ingredients and transparency, we've created more of like a movement than a product. And so that's why people share. And that was what made it work with influencers initially, was we're not here to just have you say, oh, these are the cool new, you know, condom brand. This is the cool condom startup, and look at how cool their packaging is. Sure, that's part of it. But people were sharing because they were like, this brand's different. This brand stands for something. And this brand is actually making the world a better place for me. And that is a really sort of like core piece of what Seventh Generation was about, that I think we've learned a lot from and translated into the sexual wellness space, to get over some of that discomfort that people may have about like, why am I just posting about condoms?
You mentioned Facebook. We've alluded to Instagram. As a company, and they're in the news a lot, obviously, right now with privacy-related matters and all kinds of other stuff. And I think for a company like yours that's very focused on wellness and natural products and this, you know, relationship with your customer, how do you think about Facebook? How do you think about advertising in today's world?
So I think there's a lot of different parts of this. I think everybody who is listening that's been advertising on Facebook for more than 12 months knows that things have changed pretty dramatically in terms of cost of acquisition. You know, if you're in any sort of like sensitive space like we are, a lot of their ad policies are shifting all the time, which makes it really challenging to create content that then gets approved. So there's a lot of different dynamics going on. I think one lesson that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to is you never want to put all your eggs in one basket, especially with platforms like Facebook, which aren't brand new, but are still new. I mean, an analogy I keep going back to is like, let's compare television advertising to Facebook. TV has had to figure out what they're comfortable with and what their policies are around the condom category for more than a few years. They probably figured that out 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And so while it's a more expensive channel to get into, and there's other complications because you probably can't advertise condoms during the Today Show, they sort of have figured out what they're comfortable with and where they're at. Things and places like Facebook, Instagram, Quantcast, I mean, all of these newer platforms are still figuring that out. And so for a brand, it's challenging to operate and really create an advertising strategy and a content strategy when the rules are always shifting. One week on Facebook, condoms on bananas are a no-go. The next week, they're fine. Like, how do you really operate successfully in that type of environment? So I've been really focused on diversification. Now we don't have one channel with the majority of our advertising budget, which I think is critical for anybody in this day and age, where we have a bigger budget always scoped out for testing new channels. And, you know, again, sometimes it's tough because Facebook's having a great week and you want to shift all your budget back in that. But I think with platforms, particularly like Facebook, who are going through these turmoil times, you can't be dependent on them, because if you're in a sensitive category, or even if you're not, the cost structure or the ad policies are changing constantly, that you have to focus on diversification.
Yeah, the other part, and I don't know if it really if it affects you necessarily, but I wonder more and more whether, you know, with things like GDPR and consumers, you know, having a little bit more of an insight on like their privacy and retargeting and all these different things, whether companies start to have more of a moral imperative to avoid like very specific kinds of targeting. And I don't know if it affects you in particular, if you're like targeting, if Facebook even offers ways to target people who would be a better match for your products. It seems like actually things have become more normalized. Like maybe 5 years ago, it seemed weirder that ads were following you around the web.
Right.
And now it seems more normal, I guess. But I wonder if that pendulum is going to swing back in the other direction and people are going to be against that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny. I'm totally desensitized to it now. I'm basically like, okay, somebody probably has access to my credit cards, my bank account, my email. Like, yeah. It's like there's nowhere to hide and there's nothing to hide. One thing that I've been thinking about, which is interesting based on what you're talking about, is, you know, there's this huge shift now into like voice activated search. And I think they said by 2020, 60%+ Google said of all searches are going to be triggered by voice. Now, is that creepier? Does that mean your phone's always going to be listening to you? Isn't it already always listening to you? I would say we as a brand haven't thought about that enough yet in terms of like, what does this mean in terms of how we're targeting people, what data we're accessing? I think every brand is trying to use AI or better data planning resources or softwares to get smarter about who your customer is, what she's buying, when she's buying, what else you can sell her, what other products you could create to build your LTV. But we haven't thought about that enough yet. I think the voice activation front is like the next big frontier that everybody should be thinking about. And there's decisions that we've made, like spending more time focusing on Amazon, which, you know, 2 years ago, everyone was like, no, like D2C only. I don't think D2C only is a reality for anybody anymore in terms of the long term. So if 62% or whatever it was of searches are going to be voice activated, and most of that's going to be, or a big chunk of that's through Alexa, what does that mean if you're not on Amazon?
Yeah. And they're already experimenting with advertising as a channel via Alexa.
Right.
So if you say, hey, I want condoms, you know, you can pay to be one of the first like voice results, which is just a very new way of buying that we've never even thought about, really.
Yeah. And I think everyone should be thinking about it. I think we're trying to figure out how to think about it. And I think, as I said, some of these decisions that are more like macro about just making sure you're really strong on Amazon is us starting to think about it. But it's going to change how you advertise, where you're sold, like which channels you're investing in. A lot of this is going to come through Google and like their devices or Chrome or, you know, and so does that mean you need to be investing more there versus Facebook? I think it's going to dramatically shift sort of the advertising landscape.
Does Amazon tell you if someone bought through Alexa?
I don't know the answer to that, but it's a great question. That'd probably not, because they're so secretive about everything, even with their vendors.
Yeah, but it seems like they'd want to promote somehow, you know. I don't even know how it really works. Can you set up your keywords or anything in a way that helps voice searching in particular? It's a really fascinating area.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing that I heard, I was at an event last week, was that Amazon, I guess, has taken a stand that they're not going to do what you're sort of saying, that they don't want to be using, basically paying, allowing people to pay to show up first via voice, that they're going to prioritize like order history over sponsored ads. But I think, again, it's like the Wild West. Nobody knows what they're going to do yet. And I wouldn't be surprised if they changed their mind.
I'm sure that if you've ordered something before, you could say like reorder that thing and it'll make that, that aspect easy. But, and that's a challenge. And I don't know if you, you are affected by this yet, but Amazon's going into every vertical and creating their own private label. Do they have private label condoms by now on Amazon?
They don't.
Like their own Amazon brand?
No, but they do have private label period products. Tampons and pads. It's funny. So I've wrestled with this and people bring it up all the time. This is also like not new. Seventh Generation was making private label products for Whole Foods 15 years ago, and competing with themselves effectively at shelf. So it's inevitable. I think it's sort of like the age old, this is just what happens when retailers get to a certain scale and they're using their sort of customer base and storefront as a way to see what people like. Goop is doing it too. Amazon's obviously a bigger threat, but like Goop and these other third party sites are doing the exact same thing. It's a strategy. So it's not keeping me up at night. I think, again, it just goes back to brand. And you need to build a really strong brand and a really compelling case for consumers to want to buy from you over private label. You have to offer more. You have to engage them in a different way. It's actually a challenge that all of the D2C brands can learn a lot from, you know, CPG companies forever. You know, it's not a new problem.
Let's talk about sustainability, because that is one of your core values in the areas that you're trying to innovate in. You mentioned your products are all natural. I was wondering what that means and how you approach sustainability.
Yeah, that's a good question. All natural kind of feels like meaningless a little bit now, I feel like, because anyone can say it. And what does it really mean? I think sustainability is table stakes, honestly, at this point with consumer products. Like, I think coming out with a brand of women's health products that didn't have healthy ingredients or safe ingredients is just not a great strategy. So for us, it's a non-negotiable. We obviously, you know, Seventh Generation blood running through my veins, like it's paramount. In order to make an impact, in order to make the world a better place, you need to rethink your entire supply chain. You need to make sure you're not polluting when you're sourcing product, when you're manufacturing product, but then also the product that the consumer is using is actually good for them and not causing any additional harm. So I think there's been a lot of progress just across the board, and all new brands are sort of launching with sustainability as part of their strategy or as part of their value set, because it is demanded by consumers more and more each year. But for us, it's also challenging, right? Because we're in the medical device space. So communicating about, we can't say our condoms are safer. All condoms are the same amount of safe. The FDA, you know, tests and monitors and approves any new condom on the market. So communicating about it is actually, I think, what's gotten more challenging. Because as you said, what does all natural mean? What it means for us is just that we are only using ingredients that have been proven to be safe, versus some other brands in all of the categories we're in are using ingredients which the FDA has approved, but there has not been long-term research sort of saying these will not cause any negative impacts to you over your lifetime.
But you've gone through, and part of it is getting certifications. You know, you've done the B Corp thing, you're cruelty-free. There are all of these like types of certifications. That's kind of, I think maybe that's what you're saying when you're describing, so the baseline table stakes, and then going above and beyond. Are there specific initiatives or things that you think about when you're trying to think about the long-term mission of Sustain? Like, what can you do over the long term to really move the industry in a different direction?
Yeah, going into the certifications, because as we're saying, all natural, and that natural claim has become sort of meaningless. You need to engage with certification agencies and upkeep them to sort of hold you accountable and give your brand meaning from a sustainability standpoint.
And that's not easy. I didn't want mean to sweep that under the rug either.
And it's expensive. It takes up a lot of bandwidth on our side, and it's expensive, but it's critical from my standpoint, because otherwise who's holding you accountable? On the question of sort of like, how do you continue to push the business forward from a sustainability standpoint? And for us, that's, you know, we're always rethinking, how can we become more sustainable? We just switched all of our cotton in our post-play wipes from cotton to reclaimed cotton, because it's a massive impact in terms of the sustainability and impact on the environment. Another one is, you know, we sell tampons. We sell tampons and pads via subscription. That's a lot of our bread and butter. But that's not the most sustainable option when it comes to period products. The most sustainable option is a reusable menstrual cup. And there's an argument to say, well, that doesn't make sense with your strategy, because you're sort of building a business based on the subscriber base. But it didn't matter. I mean, for me, it's like, if we're really going to change the world and we're going to make a better planet and we're going to empower women to have choices when it comes to these products, we have to have all the options, and we have to provide this option. It doesn't matter that it's not a repeat purchase.
Yeah. I say this all the time because, Limi, obviously, as a packaging company, we get asked this a lot. But my goal with building Limi is to make a packaging company that sells less packaging. And that seems counterintuitive, but I think it's sort of a similar philosophy as what you're describing. Do what's right. With this product, I want you to go a little bit more in depth on this, because I think that, obviously, like, probably half the people listening are guys and don't even know what a period cup is. So maybe you can educate us a little bit on what that is and how it's better than tampons.
So a really cool visualization is that on average, a woman who uses tampons will use about 720 tampons over 3 years. And that can all be replaced with one period cup. The period cup is, I like to describe it as like the size of like a small shot glass. It's made out of medical grade, body safe silicone. You put it in, it sits inside of your body. Your menstrual fluid fills up. You take it out every 6 hours, rinse it out. You can put it right back in for another 6 hours. You should also clean it and disinfect it every day as well. But it's, you know, it's reusable. And you can use it for up to 3 years. So it's sort of a night and day in terms of like the waste generation that happens from using disposable products to switching to the period cup. I guess you could sort of think of it as like using a plastic straw every day or using one metal straw for 3 years.
Can you give me a sense of how popular that is as an option compared to everything else that's on the market?
So it's a much smaller, I think the cup category is about 30 to 40 million in the US, whereas the tampon and pad industry is about 3 billion. So it's a massive difference in terms of the size, but it's growing exponentially. So the cup is actually, we didn't invent the cup. I'm not taking credit for that. The cup's been around for over 10 years, and we just created what we think is a, you know, more flexible, better version of it. But it's not new. I think the adoption to it has sort of grown exponentially because, for a lot of reasons, consumers are getting more conscious about the environment. They want reusable solutions. There's a huge cost-saving element. It's way cheaper to buy one $40 cup than it is to buy 720 tampons over 3 years. It just makes sense. And I think a really kind of crazy thing, too, is, which I didn't totally recognize when we were talking about getting into the spaces, as women become increasingly comfortable with their bodies and their reproductive health and their sexual health and their vaginas, it makes sense that you would then go for the more quote unquote challenging option. I mean, the cup isn't as easy as just putting a pad on your underwear and just hitting the road. You have to learn how to put it inside of you, make sure you like it, find the right size. It's definitely like a little more advanced.
Is that something, a barrier that you have when you're describing the product? People are concerned about the comfort or how it's going to fit, or if it's going to be as leak-proof, I guess? Or like, how do you, what are the biggest concerns and how do you address them?
Well, I think one of the biggest concerns is a lot of women don't even like know what their vaginal canal is shaped like, and they can't even understand like where does it sit, where does it go, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
So that's a challenge. But I think, yeah, people, the biggest question is like, how big is it? Because when you just say it's a cup or it's the size of a shot glass, that's not a great example because there's a lot of different shot glass sizes. I probably need to come up with a better analogy. Women are mostly just concerned with the size of it. And like, then you're like, well, remember, if and when you have a child, that will also come out of you. So there's plenty of space for the cup. But yeah, there it's a...
It looks like half of a small lime. I don't know. I'm looking at the website.
Smaller.
Smaller?
Tiny. Yeah.
I'm looking at the... I can't tell the size of this person's hands on your website.
That's another thing. Hands are not a consistent size. So we need to put it next to something like a lemon. Well, that could also be. But... We need to figure out how to communicate exactly what size it is. But it's...
What is the closest fruit that it... Fruit sizes, I think, makes sense.
You could probably throw like 4 blueberries in it, 4 or 5 blueberries.
Oh, 4 blueberries? Like, oh, wow. That's a lot smaller than I thought.
Yeah.
It's, so it's the size of one large strawberry.
Yes. Great. Organic strawberry. It's small. If you watch the video at trythecup.com of all these women interacting with it, people are like, oh my God, this is so much smaller than I thought it would be. So size and communicating that, but also it's a consumer behavior shift. Like, it's not just a healthier tampon or a healthier pad that's more absorbent. It's a really different way to do your period, and it takes some thought.
Hey, so we're wrapping up here, but I wanted to ask you about one of our guests, episode 38, was Heidi Zak. She's the founder of Third Love. She's an investor in Sustain. I'd love for you to tell the story behind that.
Of course. And Heidi's great. And I've been like so amazed by how they've really taken sort of a values-driven approach to their business right now with everything going on with Victoria's Secret. So if anyone listening isn't aware of that, it's a pretty interesting story. But in terms of
it's also one of my favorite episodes. She was really great.
Oh, yeah. She's awesome. Her husband's great. They're co-founders, so they have the family business dynamic as well. I met Heidi at there's this poker game for women only that this woman in New York runs.
Wow.
And it combines like women coming and playing poker for some sort of charity with she invites a couple founders to pitch to raise money or just to share their businesses. So I was one of the businesses that was pitching and Heidi was there. You know, she was asking me, what do you do? What's your business about? What are you doing here? I was like, we're raising money. She was like, well, great. I'll invest. And she sort of, you know, everyone learns when they're raising money and it's not a thing that comes naturally to people. Like, you have to just get comfortable asking everyone because you just never know. And Heidi was one of my first experiences of just sort of being like, all right, well, you know, why don't you put in some money? And she was like, I will. And, you know, even at the time, it's not like she was like writing the whole round, but an investor like Heidi Zak and her experience with Third Love and how successful she's been is exponentially more valuable than some of the other people that you come across. So I definitely highly suggest to entrepreneurs to, obviously you need to get the big checks, you need to keep your business alive. But some of our strategic investors like Heidi, we also have the CEO of MeUndies is another investor of ours from day one. Those people have been exponentially valuable to me as mentors and advisors.
MeUndies also guests on the podcast.
Yeah,
if people want to go back to the archives. Is there anything you can point to from Heidi's help or teachings or things that she's helped you with over the past couple of years, I guess? When did she invest?
Probably like 2016.
Yeah. Is there anything you can point to that she was really helpful with or that she taught you that or that you think differently about now?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're building a business, it's really important to sort of build your cohort or your network of other founders that are a couple steps ahead of you because they've tested things that either you should test or not test and they can sort of teach you a little bit like the rules of the road. I think one area with a lot of these people that are either friends or investors like Heidi have been super great resources for is, you know, digital advertising and acquisition and all of that world is so rapidly changing that even I remember a couple of years ago, it's just like, hey, are you advertising on podcasts? Who are you working with? How's that going? Who else did you talk to? Can you connect this person on my team with yours? Are you doing inserts in your shipments? Who are you, you know, being able to just get a few steps ahead because you have this network is really critical and has been super helpful for me. And Heidi's always open with her learnings and who she's worked with and who she recommends or who she doesn't recommend. And so that's been super helpful for us.
Neat.
Yeah.
So people can check out Sustain, sustainnatural.com. You're also on Amazon if people want to buy through there. Guys, girls, if you've got kids and you want to teach them how these things work, it's for everyone. So people should go check you out. Is there anything else you want to point people to? Try the cup, you said, .com? I didn't see that.
Trythecup.com. Trythecup.com. Yeah, the only other thing is, you know, we have an amazing customer experience team. So if you're on the site, you can chat with them live. You can ask them literally anything. You would be amazed at the questions we get every day. I mean, they're not doctors, but they're super informed and experts on the space and the products and, you know, anything else that comes to mind. We've had some pretty awesome conversations with customers. So I just encourage you to go to Sustain Natural and poke around and ask them anything.
Yeah, it's a beautiful website too. I love the design of it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mika.
I'll pass that along because I certainly didn't build that myself. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.